Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 6, Discourse Number 8.
The first question. Bhagwan, to me, the most beautiful passage in the Christian scriptures ends with the words, "And Jesus wept." It occurs when he approaches Jerusalem for the last time, looks down on it in his compassion, sees all of the foolishness, futility, and pathos of mankind, and weeps. Bhagwan, does the Buddha weep? Ananda Deepes, it certainly is one of the most beautiful passages in the Christian scriptures, because it shows the humanity of Jesus. That is his unique quality. Gautama the Buddha is not so human. Jesus is both the Son of Man and the Son of God. He knows the dark valley, and he also knows the sunlit peak. And he has a very human heart. That humanity remains with him to the very end. All the Buddhas are unique. In the same situation, a Lao Tzu looking back would have laughed at the foolishness, at the ridiculousness, at the absurdity of human beings. And in the same situation, Gautama the Buddha would not have even cared to look back. That is his uniqueness. He never looks back. The past does not exist at all. Mahavira would have looked back, but would have neither wept nor laughed. This fact has to be remembered. Never compare two Buddhas, otherwise you will create great confusion for yourself, although their experience is the same, but their expressions are different, are bound to be different. They have different individualities. They have different forms of expressing their experience. Jesus remains human, very human. If you ask a Buddhist, he will say, then he is not a Buddha if he wept. When he is just going to be crucified and he is raised on the cross, he looks at the sky and says, "Have you forsaken me?" There is great complaint, the complaint of the human heart, complaining to God as a child would complain to his mother or father. Have you forsaken me? What you are trying to do to me? He is angry too. A little anger is there, which is part of being human. a little anger, a little love, a little joy. When he enters into the great temple of Jerusalem, he feels so offended by the presence of the money changers in the temple that he takes a whip in his hand and alone drives all the money changers out of the temple, turns their money changing boards upside down, creates chaos. That too is very human. That is Jesus' speciality. In the same situation, you can't think of Buddha looking at the sky, because for Buddha there is no God outside. God is within. You are looking at the empty sky. There is no one to respond. God is in the crucified person. There is no way to pray to God. Prayer is absolutely meaningless for a Buddha. He would have accepted it without any grudge, without any complaint, without any anger. He is suprahuman. His expression is absolutely suprahuman. Not for a single moment he will allow human weakness to enter in. When he was dying, he stopped his disciples from weeping and crying. He said, "You can do it when I am gone. You will have enough time. But right now, at least, while I am still alive, don't do such a stupid thing. There is nothing to weep, because there is nobody to die. Why are you weeping?" Ananda, his disciple, said, "Bhagwan, we have loved you so much. How can we avoid not feeling sad?" Buddha said, "You loved a nothingness. I was never a person, but only a presence. And I have been telling you again and again that don't think of me as a person. The person died the day I became Buddha. Gautama Siddhartha died the day enlightenment happened. Since then there has been nobody inside the house. The house is utterly empty. Hence nobody is dying. Stop crying and weeping. And if you want, later on when I am gone, you can do whatsoever you want. You will have enough time. Don't waste these precious moments in weeping." This is a totally different expression. God is multidimensional. When he is experienced, there is going to be many expressions of it. Mahavira is absolutely indifferent to everything. He will not laugh. He will not weep either. Because for him, this whole world is nothing but a dream. If you know that something is a dream, how can you weep? There is an ancient Chinese parable. Chuang Tzu used to say that parable again and again. A great king had only one son, and the son was dying. Dying of such a disease for which there was no medicine available. All the physicians have said that there is no way to save him. It is only a question of few hours, or at the most 1 or 2 days, and he will be gone. The king had loved the son so much, and he was the only son, and the king was getting old, and there was no possibility of another son. The king was sitting by the side of the bed the whole night, because this may be the last night. Near about 4 o'clock, the old king fell asleep, and he saw a dream. In the dream he saw a beautiful marble palace. He has never dreamt of such a beautiful palace. And the kingdom is so vast, and he is the king, and he is sitting on a golden throne, studded with such big diamonds and emeralds. He had emeralds and diamonds, but not so big, not so pure, without any flaw. And he had beautiful women and 12 sons. Maybe the idea of losing the only one son had created the desire for 12 sons. Maybe it was just a reflection of his actual state. This dream may be just a wish fulfillment. And he was so rejoiced, and all his sons were so wise, so healthy, such great warriors. And then suddenly his son died on the bed. The wife cried so loudly that the king's dream was shattered. He opened his eyes, looked at the dead body of the son, and didn't say a word, remained like a statue. The wife was shocked. She shook him actually and said, "Do you understand or not? Your son is dead." The king said, "I can see it, but now I am puzzled. For whom to cry? Just a minute before, I had 12 beautiful sons, very handsome, very wise, in every way skillful. And because of your crying, my dream is shattered. Those 12 sons have disappeared, and the golden throne and the marble palace and the great kingdom all have gone. Should I weep for those, or should I weep for this son? Because when I was dreaming, I had forgotten completely the son, you and the kingdom. Now I am awake, I have forgotten the dream and the beauties of the dream. What is true? For what I should cry? Because when I was seeing the dream, it was true. It appeared at least true. Now I am seeing my dead son, it appears true. But how to decide which appearance is really true? Chuang Tzu, in another parable, says the same thing. He says, "Once I dreamt that I have become a butterfly, moving from one flower to another, enjoying the sun and the wind, and then somebody awakened me. It was morning and getting late, and the sun was shining my face. As I opened the eyes, the butterfly disappeared. I was again Chuang Tzu, Since then, I have been in a confusion. The confusion is, if Chuang Tzu can dream that he is a butterfly, why not the butterfly can dream that sees Chuang Tzu? He seems to be very penetrating. This puzzle is something worth meditating. If Chuang Tzu can become a butterfly in the dream, the butterfly may have fallen asleep, sitting on some tree. Under the shade of a tree, the butterfly may have fallen into a sleep and dreaming that sees Chuang Tzu. Now who is right? And what is a dream? Both seems to be similar. A man like Buddha knows the falseness of the whole world. He will not weep. He will not laugh. He will not even look back. That is his way of expressing his experience of the total. Mahavira will look back because he has also great compassion, but different from Jesus. He will not weep because it helps nobody. If you weep for the world, it does not help the world. If you weep at the stupidity of people, it makes you look silly, that's all. It does not help people. But Lao Tzu would have certainly laughed. Because looking at people's absurdity, their ridiculousness, what else you can do? Lao Tzu used to ride on a water buffalo. Moving from one place to another. He was a jolly fellow. Telling jokes, telling stories to people. Always in a laughing state. If you see the statues of Buddha that have been made in China and Japan, you will be surprised. They don't look like Buddha. Not particularly like the Indian statues. Not at all. The Indian statue has a very athletic form. Buddha has a big chest and a very small belly. No belly at all. His body seems to be very proportionate. But the Chinese Buddha has a big belly. The chest is completely sunk in. The belly is too big. And not only the belly is big, even in marble statues, you can see the belly laughing. There are ripples of laughter on the belly. It has been conceived according to the Taoist idea. Because China could understand only if Buddha was presented in the form of Lao Tzu. They knew Lao Tzu. They were acquainted with this enlightened man. And he was always laughing. There is nothing to weep for him. What is there to weep at the ridiculousness of man? 3 college boys, upon entering their favorite juke joint to sit at their usual table, found it to be occupied by an oldest woman. After debating what to do about the situation, they finally decided to embarrass the woman into leaving. Sitting next to the old lady, the first student proceeded, "Say, John," he said, "did you know that I was born 3 months before my parents were married?" "Why, that's nothing," said the next one. "I was born 6 months before my parents were married." "Fellows," replied the last of the hungry men, "I was born without my parents being married." The old lady finally looked up from the table and pleasantly asked, "Will one of you bastards please pass the salt?" Life is ridiculous. You never know what is going to happen. It is absurd. An artist's model arrived at her boss's studio and was waiting for him to arrive. When he walked in the door, she headed for the dressing room to get undressed. But he said, "No, don't bother getting ready. I have got a terrific hangover and really don't feel like working today. But why don't you stay and join me in a cup of coffee?" The model said, "I would love to." Just then the artist heard the familiar footsteps approaching the door. "Ah, my gosh," he gasped, "here comes my wife. Get your clothes off, quick." Laos would laugh. Jesus wept. Now it is for you to choose. I love both the men. In fact, a laughing and weeping are two sides of the same coin. And because of this story that Jesus wept, I say something which Christians have denied down the ages. Christians have been telling that Jesus never laughed. Now a man who is capable of weeping is bound to be capable of laughing. It is impossible to weep if you cannot laugh. In fact, laughter and weeping are not such opposites but complementaries. Two extremes on the same spectrum. Christians say Jesus never laughed. That is an invented story. I can't believe in it. Because Jesus was not an ascetic. Yes, I can understand. Some ascetic saint never laughing, because he is so desert-like, so dry, so dull and so dead. But Jesus is a juicy man. He is not an ascetic. He enjoyed good food, good company. He enjoyed drinking wine. He enjoyed being festive with his friends. And his friends were all sorts of people. His friends were not Rotarians, gamblers, thieves, even a prostitute. Mary Magdalene was part of his company. He enjoyed the real people. If you want to see the unreal people, you can go to the meeting of a Rotary Club. There you see pseudo people, all with masks, all smiling and saying hello to each other. These are not their real faces. Their real faces, they always keep locked in their cupboards. They never take them out. Only once in a while you can have a glimpse of their real face. It happens only when they are unconscious. Maybe when they have drunken too much, you can see their real face. The unconsciousness may give you a glimpse of their truth. Gurdjieff used to give to his new disciples as much wine as possible. He will go on forcing, and when the master forces you to drink, just think of me asking you to drink. And I go on pouring and pouring. How can you say no? And trust is the first thing. So Gurdjieff will force them to eat and drink too much, then their real faces will show. That was his first contact with the disciples. The disciples were very much puzzled. They have never seen such a master. They will fall on the ground and they will start saying incoherent things, and then Gurdjieff will sit by their side and listen what they are saying, what is their face showing, because these are the real face. These are their realities. You cannot think Buddha telling people to drink, but Gurdjieff did. I cannot believe that Jesus never laughed. He lived with such alive people. Fishermen, carpenters, poor people. He was not having company with the rabbis and the pandits and the scholars and the professors. He was moving with raw people, real people of the earth. It is impossible to think that he was a sad man, that he never laughed. And if he was incapable of laugh, he would be incapable of weeping too. This statement that he wept shows with absolute certainty that he must have laughed too. That is one of the most beautiful things about Jesus I love, that he is very human. Buddha is a little cold, has no warmth, is far away. That is his beauty. We need all kinds of masters. We need all kinds of flowers in the garden. A rose has its beauty and the lotus has its beauty. The lotus will need a lake, a different situation to happen. It will have a different fragrance. But all kinds of flowers enrich the garden. The garden of Buddhahood is full of strange, unique, incomparable beings: Lao Tzu, Zarathustra, Muhammad, Mahavir, Buddha, Krishna, Christ. Now Christ is on the cross. Whenever you think about Christ, you think of the cross too. It is impossible to think them separately. They have become inseparable. If you see the cross, you will think of Christ. If you think of Christ, the cross is always there in the background. But with Krishna, it is not the cross but the flute. Now Krishna is a dancer, a singer. You cannot think of Buddha dancing, singing. It is impossible to conceive. And it will look very ridiculous too. With Krishna it fits. His whole vision of life is such that the flute fits with it. Remember this. And don't become too much attached to one form of Buddhahood. There are as many forms of Buddhahood as you can conceive. Many more Buddhas will happen in the future, which will have a totally different quality, which was never available in the past. If you become too much attached and obsessed with a certain form, you will miss other Buddhas. In Holland, there was a conference arranged by Krishnamurti followers, and Krishnamurti was coming there and is staying with the people for 7 days. His disciples had gathered from all over the world. One woman went from India, but after 2-3 days she was back. She came to see me. I said, "You came back so early, is the conference finished?" She said, "No, conference is not finished, but I am finished with Krishnamurti." I said, "What happened?" She said, "I had gone for shopping and I saw Krishnamurti purchasing a necktie. And not only purchasing a necktie, but making such fuss. At least 200 neckties were spread all over the table and nothing was liked by him. Something was wrong with something, some color was wrong, size was wrong, this was wrong, that was wrong." And she said, "I simply watched what he was doing. Is he a Buddha? A Buddha purchasing? Shopping? A Buddha looks good with a begging bowl, but a Buddha purchasing, and what, a necktie, and that too he is making so much fuss." Krishnamurti is very fastidious about his clothes. She became so frustrated, she did not attend the conference. What is the point now? This man is not a Buddha. Now what to do with this woman? To weep for her or to laugh at her? One can weep for her stupidity. Because Krishnamurti is Krishnamurti. He is not Gautam the Buddha. He is not Jesus Christ. He has his unique way of living, of expressing. He is not a renunciate. He lives in the world. And to see the point that he lives in the world and yet is not of it needs great understanding inside. this woman missed. What to do with this woman? To weep for her? She went to Holland and then came back without even listening a single talk of Krishnamurti. Are to laugh at her stupidity? And one never knows. Krishnamurti may have managed the whole thing only for this woman. Seeing that she is watching, he may have made so much fuss. Because people like Krishnamurti always want to get rid of the rubbish type of people, the stupid type of people. Gurdjieff used to do many things just to get rid of the unnecessary. Sometimes he will behave with such absurdity that the person who had come to see him will never come again, thinking that he is mad. One day he is sitting, drinking tea with 2-3 disciples, and a journalist comes to see him. He always was against the journalist to enter into the campus of his ashrama, because this was his understanding that they are bent upon to misunderstand. He asked the journalist very courteously to sit and have some tea, some cake. The journalist was very happy because he has heard that Gurdjieff always throws journalists out. He tells them in no uncertain terms that get lost. He was very much happy that he has been received with such love and compassion. And then Gurdjieff asked the woman sitting by his side, what day was yesterday? She said, Friday. And what day is today? Then the journalist became a little confused. This man cannot manage. If yesterday was Friday, then there is no point in asking what day is today. The woman says, of course today is Saturday. And he shouted at the woman. He said, how it can be? If yesterday was Friday, how it can be Saturday today? Impossible. You go and find out what day today is. The journalist escaped, thinking that this is something insane. This man is insane. He never turned back. When he had gone, Gurdjieff had a good hearty laugh. He told to the woman, you see how I got rid of that man. Now he will never come back. And he will spread the story around. And many more will be prevented from coming. One never knows how an enlightened person is going to behave with what devices. Deepesh, but your feeling that you love these words, this beautiful passage, is good. But remember that man is worth both weeping and laughing. Yes, he is in a great misery. But the misery is created by himself. He is trapped. And he suffers much. But the trap is made by himself. He is like a small child who was playing outside the house with a pile of bricks. He started making a house of bricks, standing in the middle. He went on putting brick upon brick around himself. When they came up to his neck, then he became puzzled. Then he started shouting to his mother that, "I am imprisoned, come and save me." Now he cannot get out of it, but he himself has created it. This is the situation of man. We create our misery, our hell. If you see that we go on creating it, it is worth laughing. But if you say and see that maybe we created, but still we are suffering, it is worth weeping. But Buddha will not do any. He will remain detached, cool. He will not suffer because you are suffering. And he will not even think your misery worth laughing. He will keep his cool. He will do whatsoever he can do to help you and will go on passing you. Whether you are helped or not is not his business. His business is to say. Even that he had agreed very reluctantly when he became enlightened. For 7 days he remained silent. The story is, guards became very much worried, because it rarely happens that a man becomes enlightened. Now this Siddhartha has become enlightened, and he has not spoken a single word for 7 days. They looked deep into the consciousness of Siddhartha and they saw that he is not going to speak at all. They came down to the earth, bowed down to Buddha and asked him to speak, because there are many who will be helped. Buddha said to them that, "I had thought about it, but there are only two alternatives. One is, I will speak, but I will be understood only by very few people. The majority will not understand. Maybe 99% people will not understand it at all. So 99% of my effort is going to be a sheer wastage. The 1% who will be able to understand me, my insight says that even without me, sooner or later they will find on their own. Their intelligence is such, their courage is such, their search is such. They are passionate lovers of truth. That's why they will be able to understand me. The 99% will never understand. The 1% who are capable of understanding me will understand it anyway, whether I speak or not. In fact, it will be easier for them to understand if I don't speak. My silence will be more of a communion to them. So what is the point of speaking?" The guards were very much worried how to answer this. They gathered together, they discussed among themselves, then they came again with a new argument. And they said, "Listen, you are right. There are people who will never understand you. And there are people who will understand even without your saying a single word. But can you deny that there are people between these two? Can you say there is not a single person who is just between these two categories, a third category? Who will understand if you speak, and who will never understand if you don't speak? Can you deny? It may be a very small minority, maybe one in a million, but can you deny that one single person, the link between the majority and the minority, the non-understanders and the understanders, they are linked? Buddha could not deny it. He said, you are true, there are few people, yes, one in a million, who will be helped. Then those gods said, even if it is only one in a million, to help him is your duty. It is because of this argument Buddha started speaking. Otherwise he was not even going to speak. And remember, there have been many Buddhas who have not spoken. Their whole life they remained silent. You will never hear about them because they have never spoken. No scripture exists to describe them. One point I would like to make very clear to you, that each individual, when he becomes enlightened, becomes part of the universal, but his expression still remains individual. His experience is universal, but his expression is individual. If he was a poet before, for example, like Kabir, when he becomes enlightened, he will sing songs. If he was a poet, if being a poet was part of his individuality, now knowing the universal, his understanding, his light will start flowing into the old patterns of poetry. He will be like Kabir, Nanak, Farid. But if he was a painter and not a poet, and he becomes enlightened, then he will paint. That will be his natural way of expressing. If he was a sculptor, then his expression will be different. Each Buddha lives in the universal, but expresses himself individually. This is Jesus' expression. He is all too human. Maybe that is his appeal. Now half the earth is almost in love with Jesus. The reason is his humanity. Buddha is a far away star. Jesus seems to be very close to the heart. Buddha appeals to the very sophisticated. Jesus' appeal is for the masses. Whenever a country becomes sophisticated, cultured, educated, rich, affluent, Jesus' appeal starts disappearing. That's what is happening in America. Buddha is coming more and more powerful. More and more Zen centers are being opened. More and more people are becoming converted from prayer to meditation. More and more people are becoming interested into the sayings of Buddha. Jesus is losing ground in America. He is still gaining ground in India, but he is losing ground in America. America is now in the same affluent state as India was in the times of Buddha. The country was rich, people were well educated, sophisticated, cultured. They knew what philosophy is. They knew all the flights of metaphysics. They knew the highest peaks, at least intellectually. And Buddha was speaking to this intelligentsia. It was a totally different communication. Jesus was talking to the poor villagers, farmers, gardeners, fishermen. He was speaking to the lowest, the poorest of the poor. His language is different. It is very human. It has to be. Buddha's language is very pure, philosophical, metaphysical. It is less concerned whether you understand it or not. It is more concerned to be true, to be closer to truth, as closer as possible. Hence their expressions are bound to be different. Dipesh, you ask me, Bhagwan, does the Buddha weep? Few Buddhas do, few Buddhas don't. It all depends on the individuality. It happened when Baso's master died. Baso is a Buddha. A Buddha who writes poetry. A Buddha who paints beautiful pictures. A very aesthetic Buddha. His master died. Thousands of people gathered. His master was very famous. More famous because of Baso. Because Baso was a famous poet and painter. And he was Baso's master. Thousands of people gathered. And they were very much surprised when they saw Baso crying, big tears rolling down his cheeks. Few close disciples of his master came to Baso and said, "It does not look right. Thousands of people are coming and they are getting confused. They can't think a Buddha crying and weeping. And you are the man who have been saying to them again and again, there is no death. And the innermost core lives forever. Then why are you weeping? Your master is not dead. He has only moved from the small body to the universal body of God. So why are you weeping?" Vaso wiped his tears and he said, "Listen, this is nobody's business. I live according to my inner feelings. I cannot pretend. When my innermost core wants to weep, I will weep. And I don't care whether people think it right or not. If they don't think that I am enlightened, it's okay. But I cannot pretend. I cannot do something which is not really there. And yes, I have said that the soul is immortal. And my master has not died. He has disappeared into the universal. That's why I am crying. Not crying that he is dead, but crying that now I will never be able to see his form. Now he has become formless and his body was also beautiful. I will never be able to look again into those deep eyes. I will never be able to hold his hand and his feet. I have lost his form. I am crying for his body, for his form. I am not crying for the formless soul. And I am not concerned whether people think me enlightened or unenlightened. That is their business. Who cares? Now this is Basso's approach. And he too is true. But never compare. Let each Buddha be a Himalayan peak separate from other peaks. Let each Buddha be understood according to his own way. Never impose any other pattern on him. That has been done down the ages again and again. The Christian can't believe that Buddha is a Christ because he does not serve the poor. He does not heal the wounded. He does not make the blind see. He does not do miracles like Jesus did. Lazarus died and Jesus came, and after 4 days he revived Lazarus back. Buddha does nothing like that. On the contrary, he does something absolutely different. There is a beautiful story. A woman lost his young son just few days before her husband has died. Kisa Gautami was her name. And now her only son has died. She was in great despair, naturally. The child was her only hope. Buddha was staying in the town. People said, "Don't cry and don't weep. Why don't you take the child to the Buddha? He is so compassionate. He may revive him back to life." The woman rushed with the dead body of the child. Buddha looked at the woman, told the woman to put the child in front of him, and said to her, "Yes, I will revive him, but you will have to fulfill one condition." The woman said, "I am ready to give even my life. Say any condition and I will fulfill." Buddha said, "It is a simple condition. I never make big requirements from people. It's small requirements. This is a very simple thing. You just go in the town and bring few mustard seeds. Just remember one thing. The mustard seeds should come from a house where nobody has ever died." The woman was in an insane state. She could not see the point. How can you find the house where nobody has ever died? She rushed with great hope. And she knew that every house has mustard seed, because that was the only crop the people were doing. The whole village was doing the same work, growing mustard seed. So there was no question. She knocked on many doors. The people said, "Few mustard seeds? We can bring cart loads of mustard seeds. But the condition we cannot fulfill. Many people have died in our house. So our mustard seed won't do." By the evening, the woman came to her senses. She knocked on many doors. Slowly, slowly she saw the point that death is inevitable. It happens to everybody, that nobody can escape from it. She came back. She was a totally different woman when she came back in the evening. The child was there. Buddha was waiting. He said, "Where are the mustard seed?" The woman laughed, fell down in his feet and said, "Initiate me into your path, because I have understood your message that everybody has to die. Today my son has died. Few days before my husband died. few days afterwards I am going to die. Before I die, I want to see the deathless. Now I am not interested in my child being raised from the dead. I am interested in seeing myself the eternal life. Buddha initiated Kesa Gautami. Now these stories are the same, almost the same. Lazarus' sisters were Jesus' disciples. They sent for him. He was away. He came. It took 4 days for him to reach. And he raised Lazarus from the dead. But what happened to Lazarus then? He must have died again. Because we don't see him anywhere. So what is the point? If you ask Buddha, he will say, what is the point of raising the man? He will die again. You are simply creating another opportunity to die. Once is enough. Why twice? Buddha would have responded in a totally different way. Christians can't understand it because they are obsessed with the idea of Christ. They would like Buddha and Mahavira and Krishna to behave in the same way. That is not possible. Buddhists cannot understand Christ either because they have the idea of Buddha, the image of Buddha, and Jesus does not fulfill it. In fact, there is no need for Jesus to fulfill anybody else's idea or for Buddha to fulfill anybody's expectation. They are unique people. We should stop this continuous comparison. Thousands of books are written every year comparing, and every comparison is going to be wrong. It is going to do some injustice to somebody or other. Either you will be unjust to Buddha or to Christ. You cannot be just to both. My effort here is to make you aware of the varieties of Buddhahood, of the multidimensionality of enlightenment. The world is rich because there are so many birds and so many trees and so many flowers, and the same is true about the inner world. So many possibilities of growing, so many different unique expressions when you have become mature. Different flowers. The world is richer because there is a Buddha and a Christ and a Laos. The world would have been really very poor if there were only Ramas, just Ramas. The world would have been very poor. In each village and town you can find few Ramas carrying their bow. Or if there were millions of Christs everywhere, it would not be beautiful. It would be boring. It is good that Jesus has the touch of humanity and Buddha has pure divinity. The second question: Bhagwan, what is coincidence? Anand Viramo, there are three things to be understood. One is the law of cause and effect. That applies to the material world. And because science believes only in the law of cause and effect, it denies everything else. The law of cause and effect is mechanical. There is no coincidence then. You heat the water to 100 degrees and it evaporates. There is no coincidence. It is not that one day it evaporates on 99 degrees, another day on 90 degrees. There is no question of the mood. The water cannot decide. The water is mechanically ruled by a law of cause and effect. Those who believe in the law of cause and effect, they will not believe in any coincidence. Everything is predetermined. There is nothing like coincidence. Everything has an inevitability. Then there is another law. Carl Gustav Jung called it the law of synchronicity. Two things can happen together, although they are not related as cause and effect. For example, if somebody is singing a beautiful song, some chord in your heart is touched, but it is not inevitable. It is not cause and effect. It may happen, it may not happen. It may happen to few, it may not happen to few others. It may happen to you one day, it may not happen to you another day. Today you are feeling happy. You have met your woman, your friend. You are riding on the winds. Somebody is singing a song. Suddenly, it strikes a note in you. You also feel like singing. Somebody is dancing. Your feet suddenly have the feel to dance, the mood to dance. But your wife has died, and you are sad, and somebody is singing, and it hurts. The moon has risen in the sky, full moon night, and you are sad. The moon also looks sad, not beautiful. You are in such a sad state that the beautiful moon night looks like ridiculing you, looks so indifferent to you, so unconcerned, so harsh. You are in such a sad state, and the moon is still shining the same way it used to, and the roses are blooming, and the birds are singing. Nobody seems to be concerned about you. Nobody seems to care about you. The universe seems to be very neutral, very cold. You feel hurt. You feel alienated. You feel a stranger, an outsider. Now, there will be no synchronicity. The law of synchronicity means sometimes you fit and sometimes you don't fit. It is fluid. The law of synchronicity belongs to the world of mind. just as cause and effect belong to the world of the matter, body, the law of synchronicity belongs to the world of mind, heart. Beyond these two, there is a possibility of coincidence too. That means no law pertains, or you can call it the law of freedom. That is the ultimate, the law of your innermost core. In fact, it is not a law, because it is a law of freedom. Things can happen which are not caused by anything, and which are not created by the law of synchronicity, just coincidences. Coincidence simply means that there is a possibility of freedom. Now there are people here of all the three kinds. There are here people who have come according to the law of cause and effect. They had to come. It was inevitable, unavoidable. There was something pulling them like a magnet. They could not resist it. There are people here who have come not through the law of cause and effect, but they felt a synchronicity, a harmony with me, a deep akash. If they wanted to resist, they could have resisted very easily. If they wanted not to come, they would have remained home. There was not some gravitational pull. They had to choose. It is out of their choice that they are here. And there are the third category people also, who have just come as a coincidence, accidental. A friend was here, and you had come to see your friend, not to see me, not to listen to me, not at all concerned about me. You had come just to see your friend, but then you got caught. The friend may not be anymore here. The friend may have escaped. Now this is coincidence. Your husband was coming here and you simply followed him just as a dutiful wife. Now there are many children, many kids, who are coincidentally here. Their parents are here, so they are here. Their being here is not their choice, just a coincidence. Their parents are Christian, they are Christian. Their parents are Hindu, they are Hindu. Their parents have become sannyasins, they have become sannyasins. This is just coincidence. All these three things happen. The higher you rise, the higher your consciousness is, the more aware you become. of freedom. At the lowest point, everything is determined. At the highest point, nothing is determined. Buddha renounced his palace, and the first day when he was walking on the bank of a river, he created much confusion in the mind of a great astrologer. The astrologer was coming from Varanasi. He has achieved the highest degrees possible in those days. He has become the most famous astrologer. Now he is going back to his part of the country. He saw on wet sand Buddha's footprint. He could not believe his eyes because it was against all his astrological knowledge. The feet of the Buddha has few marks which were clearly there on the sand. Those marks are thought to be only to belong to a man who is the ruler of the whole world, a Chakravartin, who is the ruler of 6 continents. Now, what the ruler of 6 continents is doing in this poor village, on this dirty bank, and why the emperor of all the 6 continents should walk barefooted? He could not believe his eyes. He studied very minutely the footprints, and there was no suspicion, no doubt. Either his astrological books are right, or some emperor has passed from here. He followed those footprints in search of the man. He found Buddha sitting under a tree. Now he was more puzzled. The man looked like as if he is the emperor of all the 6 continents, and yet he was a beggar with a begging bowl. He bowed down to Buddha and he said, "I would like to see your feet. I am an astrologer. You may have heard my name." He looked at the feet and he said, "Now you have created such confusion in my mind. I have never been so confused. For 12 years I have studied astrology. Should I throw my scriptures into the river and forget all about it? You should be the emperor of the whole world. What are you doing here? How you can be a beggar?" Buddha laughed and he said, "Yes, there is no need to throw your books. There is no need to be so confused. Your books are right. I was meant to be a great king. But that belongs to the law of cause and effect. If I had simply followed the pattern in which I was born, then I would have been the king, a great king, a Chakravartin. But because I renounced, I took a conscious, deliberate step against the pattern that was imposed, imprinted in my being, I revolted against it. I rebelled against it. I became free of it. I became a witness of it. I dropped my identification with the mind. And once you drop your identification with the mind, you are no more under the law of cause and effect. First you enter into the world of synchronicity, and then ultimately you enter into the world of freedom. In the world of freedom there are only coincidences. Nothing is absolutely certain. Everything is possible. Nothing is impossible. Napoleon is reported to have said that nothing is impossible. But Napoleon cannot say that. He should not say it. A Buddha can say nothing is impossible. All things become possible. You ask me, Viramo, what is coincidence? It simply means that life is not just mechanical. It is not determined by fate, and it is not determined by history. It is not determined by your past or by your past karmas. It is not determined, as Karl Marx says, by historical necessity. It is not determined. It is determined only for those who live unconsciously. Otherwise, it is freedom. You can choose. And you can choose anything to be. You can even choose to be a nothingness. That is the ultimate freedom. And coincidences are always happening in the ordinary life too. Life is not so logical as you think. It is very illogical. Only the surface looks logical. The preacher decided to enumerate the 10 commandments to his flock. When he got to "Thou shalt not steal," he noticed a fellow in the first row acting nervously. When the preacher got to "Thou shalt not commit adultery," he noticed the fellow brighten up and smile. After the service, the preacher approached the man and asked him the reason for his unseemly conduct, to which the happy one replied, "When you said, 'Thou shalt not steal,' I discovered my umbrella was gone. But when you said, 'Thou shalt not commit adultery,' I remembered where I had left it." A bachelor named Clem showed up at his weekly poker game with a black eye. His friend Joe asked what had happened to him. "Well," Clem replied, "when I was getting dressed this morning, a button came off my pants. I don't know how to sew a thing, so I went to the next apartment and asked the woman there if she would sew it on me. For me." "Ah, boy," Joe said, "she probably thought you were making a pass and shocked you." "Who?" "No, that was not it," said Clem. "She was as nice about it as she could be. Got out a needle and thread right then and there. She sat down in front of me and sewed the button on while I was standing there. But just as she finished and was biting the thread off, her husband walked in." Life is not just logic. It does not follow a clean-cut path. It goes zigzag. And it is good that it is not simply logical. Otherwise, there will be no joy. there will be no surprise. You will be simply machines, not men. Coincidences never happen to machines. They can't happen to machines. They can happen only to men. It is your being conscious that makes them possible. Remove men from the earth, and all coincidences will disappear. Things will be following simple logical law. But remove men, and life loses all its beauty, because life loses its ultimate peak of evolution. The fourth question, Bhagwan, why do you go on speaking against knowledge? I have never heard you speak against ignorance. Sargam, knowledge hinders, ignorance never. Knowledge makes you egoistic, ignorance never. Knowledge is nothing but hiding your ignorance, covering it up. If there is no knowledge, you will know your ignorance, because there will be nothing to hide it. And to know that I am ignorant is the first step towards real wisdom. Hence, I never speak against ignorance. Ignorance has something beautiful about it. One thing that is beautiful about ignorance is that it can give you the right direction to move. Socrates says that I know only one thing, that I know nothing. But Socrates is one of the wisest men of the world. It happened that few people had gone to the temple of Delphi, and the oracle at Delphi declared that Socrates is the most wise man, the greatest wise man ever. Those people were very much rejoiced, because they had come from Athens. They came back, they went to Socrates and they said, "You should also rejoice. Have you heard it or not? The oracle at the temple of Delphi has declared you the greatest wise man on the earth." Socrates says, "There must be something wrong, some misunderstanding. Because I am the most ignorant. I know only one thing, that I know nothing." You go back and you tell the oracle that Socrates says he is the most ignorant person in the world. They went back, they told the oracle, and the oracle laughed and he said, "That's why I have declared him the wisest man in the world. Hence, I never speak against ignorance." Ignorance has also another beautiful thing about it, that it is yours. Knowledge is always borrowed. And something that is yours cannot be taken away from you. It cannot be stolen, robbed. But knowledge can be taken away from you very easily. It is borrowed. And when you are ignorant, you don't have any pretensions. You are simple. You are innocent. Ignorance has the quality of innocence about it. That's why children are so innocent, because they are so ignorant. Primitive people are so innocent because they are so ignorant. They are not cunning. They cannot be. They don't have enough knowledge to be cunning. Before you can be cunning, you have to be educated. Before you can be cunning, you need a university degree. The more there are universities, the more there is cunningness in the world. More people become knowledgeable, the more they are deceptive, cunning, oppressive, and they go on finding ways how to exploit others. Ignorance is pure, unadulterated. From ignorance, move towards wisdom, not towards knowledge. If ignorance becomes meditative, it becomes wisdom. If ignorance becomes interested in more and more information, then it becomes knowledge. To be knowledgeable is not going to help at all. Wisdom liberates. Wisdom is as much yours as your ignorance is yours. Knowledge not only deceives others, it deceives you too. When you know answers parrot-like, you start thinking that you really know. Because you can read and you can write, you start thinking that you know. Because you can understand words, you start thinking you know. Because your intelligence is covered with intellectuality, you start thinking that you are intelligent, but you are not intelligent, only intellectual. Intelligence is part of wisdom. Intellectuality is part of knowledge. Yes, Sargam, I speak against knowledge because there is nothing more dangerous than knowledge. It hinders you from knowing yourself. Knowledge hinders you from knowing because it gives you plastic, synthetic, false things to play with, and you forget all about the real thing. Don't start believing in words. It is the most dangerous game one can play. Don't be a parrot. Otherwise you will be going farther and farther away from your inner source. One very hot day, a dog was walking along a road when he saw a takeaway food shop. He went in and asked for a can of lemonade. "Get out," said the shopkeeper. "Dogs are not allowed in food shops." "But look here," said the thirsty canine. "You have got a big sign outside that says, 'We serve hot dogs.'" Just knowing the words is not enough. And you are going to become more and more confused the more words you know. Because you don't know, your words are just on the surface. If somebody scratches a little bit more, your ignorance is bound to sow. People go on pretending. When I was a student in the university, I had a professor who was not even very much knowledgeable. Wisdom is out of question. But he had this habit of pretending. Whenever anybody will mention any name of a philosopher, author, poet, mystic, or any name of some book, he will immediately say, "Yes, I have read the book, it is beautiful," or this and that. He will make some comment. But I could see in his eyes that the answer that he was giving was hollow. He has not read the book. He knows nothing about the person. And nobody has ever seen him in the library. I had gone to his house also. I had not seen any books there. I inquired in the library. For 10 years he had been in the university, not a single book has been issued in his name. Nobody has ever seen him reading, except the newspaper. He was not reading anything else. That too he used to borrow from the neighbors. I inquired everything, and I became absolutely certain that he simply pretends. One day I invented 3 names. Just invented. I told him, "Have you read, sir, Namineev's book?" He said, "Yes." Now there is no person like Namineev. I asked him, "Can you tell me the name of his book?" He looked a little puzzled. He said, "I must have read it many years before. I have forgotten the name. You can inquire in the library." I said, "You come along." In the library, there was no name like Namineev. No book he has written, because he has never been, so how he can write a book? I told him that the other 2 names were also inventions, and you have agreed. And few books also, you have agreed, don't exist. He took me aside and said, "Listen, don't tell it to anybody. But I don't know a thing about these books. But one has to keep one's face. I don't want to look stupid. People go on trying to pretend what they are not. Knowledge gives you the greatest pretension. You can quote Buddha, Jesus, and you don't understand what they are saying. And you will always do something wrong. You will interpret them in a wrong way. In India, on Bhagavad Gita, there are thousands of commentaries. Now, either Krishna was mad, insane, then there can be thousands of meanings to his words. Krishna was very particular what he wanted to say. But how then you explain these thousands of commentaries? These are people imposing their meanings on Krishna. If he comes back and looks at the commentaries, he himself will get puzzled. He will himself be in a difficulty to decide what was really his meaning. And these people are very argumentative. Anybody can prove anything. Sankara proves in Gita that it is the philosophy of renouncing the world. The world is illusion. And Gita preaches renunciation. And he proves beautifully. His contemporary, Ramanuja, proves just the opposite. That Gita teaches live in the world and be a devotee of God. It does not preach renunciation. It teaches the art of living in the world with prayer. And Lokman Tilak finds something else. He says Gita preaches action. Of course, with great detachment, but you have to act. These three are the paths, ancient paths, the path of no action, inaction, that is Sankara, finding in Gita. The path of action, that is Lokman Tilak, finding in Gita. And the third is the path of devotion, Ramanuja, finding the third in the same book. And then there are different variations of the theme. Knowledgeable people can go on imposing their own ideas of those who have known. The right way to come across a book like Gita, Bible or Quran is not to have any ideas, not to have any knowledge. Encounter them with great silence, just like a mirror, reflecting only, not interpreting. Then you will be able to see the real meaning. Their meaning, not your meaning imposed on their meaning. And the man who can become a mirror needs not to go to Gita or Quran or Bible. He can find the message in the trees, in the song of the birds, in the clouds, in the sun, in the moon. He can find it anywhere, because God's message is written all over existence. On each leaf is his signature. Just you have to be mirror-like, silent, meditative, with no thought, with no knowledge. That's why I speak against knowledge. It is knowledge that has become your imprisonment. Betty was constantly losing her boyfriends because of her grandmother's tendency to say the wrong things to them in her attempt to be modern. One day her current boyfriend arrived while Betty was upstairs changing, and the old lady started to brag to him about her granddaughter. "I think Betty would rather screw than eat." Granny chatted cheerfully to the young man. There is hardly a young man around she has not screwed with, and she even has a record to screw by. The young man blushed, stammered, grabbed his hat and beat it out the door. A moment later, Betty came downstairs, noticed his absence, and said, "All right, Granny, what did you say this time?" "Nothing," protested the old lady. "I was just telling him how much you like to screw when he ran out the door." "Ah, my goodness, Granny, how many times must I tell you the word is not screw, it is twist." What happens to Jesus in your mind? What happens to Buddha in your mind is exactly something like that. Your mind does both the thing. It twists, it screws. Put your knowledge aside. Just go in deep innocence. In deep ignorance, and then you will be able to find what truth is. Truth is not found by knowledge, it is found by silence, and knowledge is noisy. The last question, Bhagwan, is it really difficult to understand you, Dhammo? It is the same old story. It has always been difficult to understand people like me. Not that you are not intelligent enough to understand it, but because you are too much knowledgeable. You already think you know, and that is the trouble. Come to me not knowing anything. Don't come to me as Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, otherwise you will misunderstand. I am saying simple things, but if you have a preoccupied mind, you are going to miss them. It was terrible, mother, complained the curvy teenager. I had to change my seat 4 times at the movies. Some men started bothering you? Asked mother. Yes, said the girl, finally. An American girl visiting England went to a posh party. She was dancing with a rather stuffy Englishman. When her necklace became unfastened and slipped inside the back of her gown, so she asked her partner to retrieve it. Though he felt rather uncomfortable about it, he courteously attempted to reach the necklace. After a couple of tries, he finally said, "I am awfully sorry, but I am having trouble getting to it. Try further down," she instructed. Just then, he noticed that all eyes in the room were on him, and he blushed beet red. He whispered to the lovely American, "I feel such a perfect ass." "Never mind about that," she said. "Just get the necklace." Different languages. I speak one language, you speak another language. By the time words reach to you, they have a totally different meaning. unless you start listening to me in the same silent space in which I am speaking to you, misunderstanding is inevitable. But it can be avoided. Be a little more meditative. Learn the ways of being more silent. And many of you are learning, and many of you have become aware of it, and many of you are testing me without misunderstanding me at all. It is going to happen to you too, Dhammo. You are new. Just get a little seasoned, a little ripe and mature. And the only maturity required here is to sit with me absolutely empty, so I can resonate within you, so I can touch your heart, so I can play upon the harp of your heart. Then the sounds created will not come from your mind. Otherwise, if you keep the mind between me and you, then whatsoever meaning you arrive at is your own. I have nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with me either. Wait a little, Dhammo. Become a little more silent. Learn how to be in communion with me. It is a love affair to be with a master. A love affair which is inexpressible in words. But one can get attuned. It is an attuning. Slowly, slowly the disciple falls into accord with the heart of the master. He breathes the way the master breathes. His heart beats in the same rhythm as the master's heart. Then understanding comes so naturally, just as your shadow follows you. Understanding follows silence. Enough for today.